Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für Damen und Herren, die ganz genau wissen, an welchem Tag the lights went out in Georgia. Heute mit einer neuen Folge aus Los Angeles. Speaking of kleine Schuppen, ich war in Las Vegas, wo ich Gelegenheit hatte, mir das Sphere anzugucken. Das Sphere ist, glaube ich, im Moment so die modernste Veranstaltungshalle, die es so gibt. Da gibt's Konzerte, Musikveranstaltungen und genau, diese Kuppel ist innen und außen bedeckt mit LEDs. Ich glaube, die LEDs nach innen für die Shows natürlich noch mal feiner eingestellt als die nach außen, aber eine unglaubliche Anzahl an Leuchtdioden, die da verbaut sind. Die ist den ganzen Tag quasi animiert nach außen hin, wird natürlich als Werbefläche benutzt. Und nach innen, wenn da keine Konzerte stattfinden, läuft da ein Film von Darren Aronofsky. 20.000 Zuschauer gehen da rein. Die LED-Leinwand innen ist 15.000 Quadratmeter groß, ist eine 16K-LED-Leinwand. Ich glaube, die einzige in der Welt im Moment. Das heißt, die Bildqualität innen ist wirklich wahnsinnig gut. Sphere wird auch mit Duft und Wind gearbeitet, auch mit allen akustischen Tricks und Methoden, die es so gibt. Die kann ich noch nicht mal aussprechen, wie die technisch funktionieren. Die Sitze bewegen sich auch. 164.000 Lautsprecher. Genau, live sind da demnächst die Backstreet Boys zu sehen. Und ich habe mir diesen Film Postcards from Earth angeguckt. Der Film dauert 55 Minuten. Es ist ziemlich teuer, $105, was für 55 Minuten Film schon ganz ordentlich ist. Und man kommt an, ich glaube, eine Dreiviertelstunde vorher wird das Foyer geöffnet. Es wird angekündigt, dass es da eine Art Ausstellung gibt. Dementsprechend war ich auch die Dreiviertelstunde vorher da. Ich finde dieses Foyer, ich war so ein bisschen underwhelmed, muss ich ehrlich sagen. Architektonisch hat mich das schon so ein bisschen an, weiß ich nicht, Einkaufsmall, Gera 2003 erinnert, ästhetisch. Es stehen dann da so Animatronic-Roboter herum, die einem so ein bisschen so eine Einführung geben, in wie die Technik da funktioniert. Aber das ist auch alles ziemlich schnell gesehen und man braucht tatsächlich keine Dreiviertelstunde dort. Es geht dann wahrscheinlich tendenziell eher wieder darum, einem nochmal irgendwie Drinks und Souvenirs zu verkaufen. Und der Film selber, man kommt dann da rein, diese Arena ist wirklich riesengroß, riesig hoch. Am Anfang täuschen sie quasi an, man sieht vorne eine Art Kinoleinwand. Ich glaube, die ist schon auch auf der LED-Leinwand zu sehen. Aber man denkt so, ah, okay, da wird das laufen. Und dort beginnt dann auch dieser Film mit so einer Art Science-Fiction-Handlung. Und irgendwann hat man so ein Bild von einer Erdkugel. Das berühmte Bild von Outer Space, guckt man runter auf die Erde und auf einmal wölbt sich diese Erde plastisch hervor, so ein 3D-Effekt. Und kommt in dieser Kuppel einem wirklich so nah. Man trägt aber keine 3D-Brille oder irgendwie sowas in der Art. Sie wird so plastisch, dass man wirklich denkt, man kann die gleich anfassen. Und dann springt dieses Bild, also aus diesem 3D-Effekt, diesem sich vorwölbenden, in diese ganze Kuppelbespielung. Das heißt, auf einmal wird nicht nur vorne so eine Art Leinwandbereich bespielt, sondern dieses Bild ist mehr oder weniger 270 Grad, es sind nicht ganz 360, aber fast 360 Grad um einen herum. Und zwar in einer Bildqualität, dass es einen aus den Schuhen haut. Zusammen mit diesen Effekten Duft. Ich wusste das erst gar nicht, dass es Duft gibt. Ich hörte nur irgendwann die Frau hinter mir wispern irgendwie, do I smell something? Und dann merkte ich, okay, es gibt tatsächlich auch so ein Duftelement von Duftdramaturgie, der damit so durchgeht. Es geht dann darum, dass nach diesem Science-Fiction-Anfang gibt es so einen Rundumschlag, Rundumreise über die Erde, Berge, Meer, Menschen, Fabriken. Und wenn dann da der Elefant durch die Savanne stapft, dann wackelt auch sozusagen, vibriert der Stuhl leise mit. Das ist schon alles wahnsinnig gut getimt und wahnsinnig gut gemacht. Oder es springt einem irgendwann mal, glaube ich, so eine Spinne entgegen oder so. Da man erschreckt sich auch schon ziemlich, auch akustisch ziemlich eindrücklich. Aber nach 6-7 Minuten, das stimmt schon, hat sich das auch auserzählt, wenn diese ganzen Effekte einmal so durchgespielt sind. Was dann von diesem Film übrig bleibt, ich weiß gar nicht genau, was einem dann da so erzählt werden soll. Am Ende, es geht dann so ein bisschen auch um den Klimawandel und dann verlassen aber die Menschen die Erde, die Erde soll sich quasi erholen, während die Menschheit auf einem anderen Planeten Let It Be Mars oder keine Ahnung was in irgendwelchen Pots lebt. Und also es ist, ich habe es nicht so ganz verstanden, was einem da genau verkauft und erzählt werden soll. Eindrücklich auf jeden Fall. Es wäre tatsächlich mal spannend zu sehen, wie das ganze Ding funktioniert, wenn dann da ein Konzert stattfindet. Eben wie gesagt, die Backstreet Boys, ich glaube, eröffnet worden ist das Ganze mit U2. Das habe ich jetzt noch nicht gesehen, aber als so eine Art von Überwältigungstheater, wirklich beeindruckend. Aber trotzdem hat es auch, das lag so ein bisschen außerhalb, nicht wirklich außerhalb der Stadt, aber es ist jetzt nicht so auf dem Strip, sondern so ein bisschen seitlich davon in Las Vegas. Das heißt, es liegt auch so ein bisschen seltsam, diese Atmosphäre im Foyer und auch wie dann dieser Zuschauerraum aussieht. Das hat schon alles so ein ganz bisschen so ein Mehrzweckhallen-Charme. Also dieser Aspekt hat mich nicht so begeistert. Überhaupt ist Las Vegas natürlich irgendwie eine wahnsinnig unwirtliche Stadt. Absurderweise, wo es ja eigentlich darum geht, dass man da zu Gast ist, Geld ausgibt, im Hotel ist. Aber wenn man so eine Art von europäischem Reisen gewohnt ist, wo man sich mal eine Stadt anguckt, das ist da eigentlich unmöglich. Ich bin Tag 1 mal so ein bisschen so mit meinem metaphorischen Stadtplan irgendwie mit den Wanderschuhen losgezogen und dachte auf einmal, Johannes, wie bescheuert bist du eigentlich? Viel zu heiß, man kann sich nirgendwo hinsetzen draußen, es gibt nirgendwo Schatten, es ist alles super weit entfernt. Ich glaube, die Stadt ist wirklich darauf angelegt, dass man quasi den ganzen Tag im Hotel abhängt, am Pool sitzt, trinkt, spielt, vielleicht mal ins Gym geht, was isst und abends, wenn überhaupt mit dem Uber irgendwo hinfährt, sich eine Show anguckt oder in einem anderen Hotel sich den Abend im Casino dort verbringt. Es ist keine Stadt, die man als wie so eine Art Sightseeing-Tourist sich an 2 Tagen angucken kann. Das erschließt sich irgendwie nicht so ganz. Irgendwie, da werden auch Düfte reingepumpt in diese Hotel-Foyers und Hotel-Spielhöllen, dass mir tatsächlich so ein bisschen schlecht wird. Ich habe eigentlich nicht den Eindruck, dass ich wahnsinnig empfindlich bin, aber da waren so ein paar Düfte dabei, wo ich wirklich so dachte, so pff. Was ich ziemlich interessant fand, so als Effekt war, ich war dann einen Abend im Neon Sign Museum auf eine Empfehlung hin. Dort werden quasi historische Neonschilder aus Las Vegas, wo es natürlich bekanntermaßen sehr viele gibt und gab, gesammelt und restauriert und ausgestellt draußen. Ich war da so genau so zur Abenddämmerung. Das ist natürlich ein schöner Moment. Und irgendwie hat mir das tatsächlich nochmal geholfen zu sehen, dass es da doch, obwohl das alles auf so Geld einnehmen und Hedonismus und wir leben im Moment ausgelegt ist, Las Vegas, dass es da trotzdem so eine Vergangenheit gibt. Wahrscheinlich ist das wieder so die europäische Seite von mir. Ich so denke, wenn es da eine Geschichte dahinter gibt, dann kann ich das besser ertragen, als wenn ich das Gefühl habe, es geht wirklich nur um das Showbusiness und das Verkaufen. Und ums Verkaufen geht es natürlich sehr stark. Das ist einfach da sehr präsent. Es werden alle Möglichkeiten sozusagen ausgeschöpft, einem möglichst charmant oder uncharmant das Geld aus der Tasche zu ziehen. Und das war auch wiederum interessant für mich, so als so ein Außenblick. Das war für mich so ein Moment in Las Vegas, wo ich so dachte, da kippt's für mich. Also das ist, da finde ich es dann irgendwie auch nicht mehr cool und habe auch keine Lust mehr, mir diese Kunst, da bin ich fast schon versucht zu sagen, kunsthandwerklichen Produkte irgendwie anzugucken. Die ich ja ansonsten sehr liebe, alles was so Broadway ist und so weiter, es kann ja auch nicht trashig genug sein für mich, aber da war so ein Moment, wo ich so dachte, so nee, da komme ich nicht mehr mit, da kann ich, das ist für mich so, da ist es für mich irgendwie überdreht. Zu unserer Gesprächspartnerin heute, Paige Person, habe ich getroffen hier in L.A., eine Künstlerin, die malt, aber auch als Drag-Performerin auftritt, unter dem Namen Paige Person. Zu Beginn hatte sie eine Karriere als Malerin, dann ist sie als Trans, hatte sie ihr Trans-Coming-out und ist so ein bisschen von der Kunstwelt verstoßen worden und hat sich in den Drag-Bereich begeben. Und inzwischen versucht sie eigentlich, beide Welten so zusammenzudenken, zusammenzubringen. Ich habe sie hier getroffen in L.A. in ihrem Studio. Wir sitzen, das kann man sich vielleicht so vorstellen, umgeben von ganz vielen Kostümen dieser Schriftzug Person ist auch immer ganz wichtiger Bestandteil sowohl ihrer Bilder als auch ihrer Kostüme. Das ist dann gestickt auf Kleider, in Pailletten, wie auch immer. Ich hatte sie angeschrieben und sie gefragt. Ich setze mich so ein bisschen mit dieser Trennung von Arts und Entertainment auseinander. Und sie hat umgehend reagiert und geschrieben, das ist ja so ihr Lebensthema und das ist quasi so eine Line, die sie irgendwie versucht zu verwischen. Umso schöner war es, dass sie mich eingeladen hat und wir uns unterhalten haben. Und ja, viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Paige Person. First, I wanted to ask you, because when I emailed you, you said like blurring the lines between arts and entertainment is exactly your kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, why is that? Or what comes to, or what came to mind when I emailed you?
Well, so my history as an artist is I had a whole career as a primarily visual artist prior to coming out as trans, which came to an abrupt end. Like 15 years ago, I started coming out as trans and all of my gallery relationships ended. All of my relationships with curators and collectors ended. And I was getting, people were literally trying to block my work from being shown because to protect its value.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And through a series of events, I ended up finding community in queer nightlife and specifically in the drag scene. And what was really surprising to me about that community was here was a group of people from very diverse socioeconomic backgrounds who were all interested in art. They had never had access to art education, but they were interested in creativity and they wanted to see envelopes being pushed. They wanted to see something they hadn't seen before. They were interested in making political statements through creative acts. And I thought, you know, this world has always felt separated from the art world to me in this hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. And having been cast out of the sort of gatekeeping, institutionalized art world, I thought, honestly, I'm kind of more on the side of this community. This community has accepted me without question and encouraged me to be creative in any way that I saw fit.
Yeah.
Whereas the art world, soon as I came out as trans, now obviously it's a different world and they want to perform, they want to check diversity boxes and give the appearance that they support trans people.
Yeah.
15 years ago, that was definitely not the case. So I kind of took the challenge to myself to, what if I made art in this world, right? And I found sometimes I would do things that were too artsy.
Ah, okay.
And would maybe not be entertaining enough. Or I would do things that felt just like entertainment. But I did find some space where I would feel like, hey, I'm actually making art in a context that's not approved by the institutional art world, but feels like forging new creative territory for me as an artist.
Yeah.
The whole time, I feel like a lot of artists feel this way, that they can't help being artists, they can't help having creative urges,
yeah.
Right? And it's the context in which you make that work.
Yeah, but did drag always play a role in your work, even before coming out as trans or before leaving the art world?
Only secretly.
Why only secretly? That would interest me. Like, was it like some kind of guilt feeling?
It was guilty pleasure.
Like
not guilty pleasure. It was fear. It was fear of being cast out.
Ah, okay. So you wouldn't incorporate elements of that into your work?
Well, so I was making paintings of feminine bodies that I didn't let anyone know were based on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing sort of secret drag performances and photographing them and making paintings from them and not ever telling anyone. So these sort of rich cishet white men were buying my art, thinking it was just conventionally attractive cis women posing. And then I started coming out and I started telling people this, and immediately the people with money said, we're not.
That's interesting. So your paintings also had like some kind of hidden element of drag
mm-hmm.
in them.
Exactly.
Without anyone knowing.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. That's subversive in a way.
Well, it felt that way. And now looking back, I can see that there's much more power in owning what you're doing and being more open about it.
Yeah.
But there was no art. There was no art world support for that. 15 years ago.
I see.
But then I found that in the drag community. And over the last several years, especially after the COVID lockdown changed things a lot for me because there was no longer an audience. So I started focusing more on painting again than performing for a live audience because there was no live audience. And in that time, I sort of reflected, well, I've spent an equal amount of years in my life doing drag as painting, and they both feel pretty similar to me. They're both coming from the same place in my, you know, as a creative person, I don't know where this stuff comes from. Like, just one minute I have a picture in my mind and I want to realize it in the world.
Yeah.
So I sort of took the challenge in 2020 to exist sort of equally in both worlds. And I would say, you know, I want to make drag in art spaces and art in drag spaces.
Yeah.
Because those distinctions, I didn't see who those distinctions were benefiting other than those of the rich art collectors that wanted to maintain value on things that weren't theirs.
I see. Yeah.
Another thing I've been thinking a lot about, especially in the last couple of weeks and months, as an entertainer, I've watched in the last couple of years so many artists try to speak up about political issues, have their shows canceled, their funding pulled, their collectors sell their work, be blacklisted by the art world for having any political stance.
Okay.
We're happy to celebrate Picasso's Guernica looking back in history, but an artist making art
gets his funding cut immediately.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas as an entertainer, it's quite the opposite. The more political I am as an entertainer, the more people support me. So if I believe in the power of art as activism, I feel a sense of freedom in the nightlife community to actually talk about things that I care about. Mm-hmm. that I would not have in a museum or gallery.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit like how you got in contact with the drag scene or how you learned?
I just found it.
Okay.
I found it in my neighborhood drag bar. My neighborhood bar had like one drag night.
Which bar was that?
As the Offbeat has a show called Exposure Drag that offers people they sort of specialize in booking first-time performers.
Yeah.
And I just started going to that as a regular. They sort of could tell that I wanted to perform and asked me to perform on the same night I was going to ask them anyway.
Okay.
So I just started performing, and it just felt so natural to me. And like I said, it was something I was already doing sort of in secret on my own. So it was really liberating for me to be able to be more seen fully as the artist that I was.
What did you learn in the drag community or from the drag community for your art? If you learned something.
I feel like an art audience wants to intellectualize things in a way that oftentimes I think that they don't even completely understand, but it feels good to be using words. They love to say the name of a philosopher in a statement, even though they haven't read or understood the work of that philosopher.
Yes.
What I learned from the drag community was that actually being myself and speaking openly about my lived experience was more valuable than me reflecting something I had lived in a book, that I had read in a book. I think a turning point for me as a drag performer was there was a time when I was harassed by a patron at a bar and then came back the next week and that patron had been hired to work security at the bar.
Okay.
So instead of doing a lip sync number like I had been doing up until that point, I was so mad that while the song was playing, I just talked to the microphone and said, last week I was here and here's what happened when this guy harassed me. And now here he is working the door. So I want him to feel as humiliated as I felt showing up here tonight and seeing him. So that was the first time I had ever really just used my own voice, speaking normally as I would speak to you,
okay,
as the medium for my artwork, to directly sort of like, you know, yes, I'm wearing a dressed in drag and have whatever artifice surrounding a drag performance, but ultimately the at the heart of that performance was using my voice directly, right, and speaking openly about something I had experienced. And then after that happened, I could never go back to doing a lip sync performance. And I thought, I've come all this way to have a voice as an artist. So, and yet here I am silencing my own voice and just moving my mouth to other people's words.
Yeah.
So I kind of, that really that brought out the era of me doing spoken word performances. And they started getting longer and turning into like 20-minute monologues like you saw at Weirdo Night. A month after that Weirdo Night, I had done a 90-minute performance at the Hammer as part of Made in L.A. Mm-hmm. last year that was called How I Became a Person. And in it, I recreated 10 performances I had done in nightclubs that to me were art, but I had sort of squeezed it into this entertainment context.
Oh, that would be so interesting.
So then I brought them back into a museum and told the story that informed that work and sort of connected them in this narrative of like, this is how I came to use my voice as my art medium and how my art is now about my full personhood and not just an aestheticized version of a part of my experience, mm-hmm. but it's closer to a reflection of my full experience as a person.
Yeah. But it's interesting that you said like you brought 10 performances you did in nightclubs into the museum. Mm-hmm. Can you in any way describe, did it felt differently playing it for an art audience or in a club or
It was a little bit different. But I will say a lot of the audience that came to see me in the museum was made up of queer and trans people that I knew from nightlife. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them said, this is my first time ever coming into a museum. And I said, well, that right there makes me feel more successful as an artist than when I sold a painting to a lot of money to a hedge fund manager.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is actually changing the demographic of who feels represented by an institution, right? So that was really important to me. And obviously, it was different, but in a way, it was sort of like we were the majority in this institution that has treated me as my community as a minority, right? So it actually forced the museum to be on the receptive side and not the gatekeeping side.
Yeah. Fascinating. Because how did you... The one I saw at the Weirdo Night, mm-hmm. the spoken word mm-hmm. thing, was a story.
It was a non-consensual drug experience.
Yes.
It was a true story of being on a date with someone I had met on an app who dosed me with a psychedelic drug called DMT and about the experience I had.
Yeah. Because it was somehow it felt like stand-up, but it was not stand-up. You know,
exactly.
That was always like, what would I categorize this at? Not that you have to, but of course, sometimes you think like that. It's like, but then again, it was not like punchline driven mm-hmm. or something driven by something else. So this was the kind of work you also did in clubs then.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, I can see the people also being a little bit maybe confused.
So here's what another thing I learned in nightlife is you can use things like glamour and comedy to sort of draw someone in to then say, here's some real thing that I experienced. If I just come out and say,
this is what happened to me,
this is what happened, people might not be as interested in hearing that. So I kind of see those things as like luring people into wanting to be receptive to hearing something that they didn't expect to hear in that context.
Yeah. And can you tell me a little bit about this person idea?
Sure. So it was a very, coming out as trans was a very long, drawn out process for me over many years. And over the course of it, I lost friends, I lost art world business relationships intellectual relationships, however you want to describe that. I was openly discriminated against by galleries I was working for. I was openly harassed by people at jobs I had. I was constantly watching my rights be politicized and taken away. And I saw trans people having to battle to prove their humanity. So I decided to make that the core of my identity as a performer is, yes, I am a person. I have to tell you this all the time because we live in a world that constantly tells me I'm not. And yet I look in the mirror and I think I'm a person, I deserve to exist. So it actually was like my message as an artist out of necessity became simpler and less intellectual and more about my fight to be seen as a human being, which I saw reflected in other people in the community. Mm-hmm. And also seeing the ways that having experienced oppression firsthand, gave me greater empathy into the struggles of, you know, like this week, the immigrant community, the disproportionate policing of Black people in this country. I started being understanding. I'm trying to think of a way to say this, mm-hmm. because obviously that's their experience is not mine, but it opened me more to empathizing with and trying to understand as much as I can, mm-hmm. from my point of view, what that must feel like. Right. Mm-hmm. So this project became just constantly repeating the word person, which is all over my art. And like my last body of paintings was sort of like a body with the word person all over it. I've gotten the word person tattooed on stage on my body as part of performances.
And you also use it on costumes, no?
Or exactly, like, exactly. Yeah. So my sort of branding, my visual branding as a performer is to just constantly be using the word person and in all of the language about me, just to think about, to remind people of my own humanity and that of not just people in the trans community, but I think in America right now, we have this huge power struggle between what we see as this hierarchy of people that needs to place people in a, I recently heard the term lowerarchy, mm-hmm. to refer to anyone that is repressed in order to make these people think that they have access to power, right?
Yeah.
Or like something that was said, I forgot by who, during the civil rights movement in the 60s here, that if you can convince the poorest white that he's better off than the best off Black person, then you have their political support.
Yeah.
So it's about critiquing power structures ultimately, but also it's a way, it's one of those things that I use to draw people into wanting to get the message, because it's a little bit funny to make something so obvious.
Yes. But does it also work as some kind of drag name?
No. It is my drag name.
It's your drag name.
Page person. Page is my actual middle name.
But it's interesting that it's like a, as well a drag name, then it's also like an, what is it called in Germany? We call it Künstlername. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes artists give themselves some kind of names. Mm-hmm. So it's also a little bit like a play with that, no? Like
exactly. Being
a, is it a drag name or an artist's name or your mm-hmm. real name? What right. kind of name is that?
I just did my legal name change and I almost...
I almost legally
changed my name to Page Person. I thought, actually, I like having some separation between my art and my life.
Yeah, yeah.
I do need to have a little bit of a boundary.
Okay, that makes sense to me, I think, to have this kind of some kind of like, it's, I don't know how you would describe it, but of course, it's also like work. Mm-hmm. It's like a work
exactly.
name.
Exactly.
Like, but how did you learn all this, like creating all this stuff? Or did you, what is it like learning by doing? Or
learning by doing and just through the community. Here's another thing about the performance world versus the art world. I made art for decades, and occasionally I would meet an artist that had influenced me, and we would maybe give some small acknowledgement to each other.
Yeah.
But generally, I felt it was very competitive and very hierarchical, and people would sort of be judging you if they felt like they were one notch above you in the hierarchy, they no longer had to talk to you. Yeah. Or if they felt like you were one notch above them, suddenly they're like, what can I get from you?
Mm-hmm.
I want people to know that I'm associated with you so I can get something out of it.
Yeah.
It's transactional. Whereas people in nightlife, I showed up knowing nothing. And people said, you're one of us. We love you. The people that had most originally inspired me in that scene, who were very talented and had done that for years, when I first started in my first month, said, you're one of us. We love you. We'll teach you anything. Right. So I certainly was not born knowing how to sew. Mm-hmm. When I first started performing, I was literally just taping trash bags to my body until it made a shape that I wanted as a silhouette on stage. And then over the years, I've learned this, that, and the other purely through word of mouth. And
do you have some kind of drag mother? Mothers?
There are multiple.
Multiple mothers. Okay.
And I have drag children as well.
Ah, okay. How many?
I have two official.
Okay.
I have a drag son and a drag daughter.
Oh, cool. do you know? Because I have the feeling, because I was in New York before, mm-hmm. and of course, like New York is a total theater town. And now I'm here, and stage-wise, I always think it's a comedy town somehow, mm-hmm. and it's a drag town
mm-hmm.
or drag city. Why is that? Why is LA this big like hub for creativity in drag, whatever that may be, West Hollywood to I don't know what.
Right. I mean, I think that LA actually has the largest LGBT population, I think maybe in the world. The LA LGBT Center is the largest LGBT organization in the world.
I've been there, yeah.
I think that the existence of West Hollywood as its own political entity, as an openly gay city within the city of Los Angeles, I think that that does a lot for it. One thing about drag has certainly been the influence of RuPaul's Drag Race mm-hmm. on that culture. And I think a lot of people come here trying to be
on the show
TV, and a lot of people know drag through that. I certainly learned about drag before that. I grew up in Atlanta when RuPaul lived there, and RuPaul was more like a punk mm-hmm. gender bending performer and like had a show on public access TV.
Yeah, he was also very rough and very mm-hmm. not experimental. I don't know the right word, but not as mainstream as
exactly.
today. Yeah.
It was very much part of the punk scene
yeah.
and new wave. Then he moved to New York and, influenced by Tyra Banks, sort of remade himself as when the track Supermodel came out. He was very much like emulating Tyra Banks, and America's Next Top Model is very much the formula for RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah.
So there is this whole world of people who learn about drag through that TV show. I'm very I kind of don't really care about that TV show.
Yeah. But how is it like also LA being this, I must say, I'm quite, because everybody warned me before coming to the SUNs, it's so expensive. I'm like, this is such an expensive city. How can you be an artist surrounded by all this money?
Well, that's new here, actually. LA okay. was pretty cheap prior to, I would say that 2020 really was a tipping point in terms of, in the years leading, and maybe 5 years leading up to that, a lot of New Yorkers had moved here and were sort of willing to like pay more rent. I was watching, you know, the artist Wu-Sang?
Yes.
Their documentary on a club that they used to do here called Wildness. I would highly recommend that documentary.
Okay.
It's available on Vimeo.
I will check
last
that.
I checked. I'll send
yeah.
a link.
Yeah.
That was made in, that was one of my sort of early club experiences, was their club Wildness. That documentary was made in 2012, and they said, yeah, so we just moved here because it's like really cheap. You can just like be an artist and be free and not really have a job. And
okay.
I moved to LA from Atlanta in 1997 and found it very easy to exist here. I could like occasionally get like a little gig doing some set design or this, that, or the other, or work for an art gallery installing shows or mm-hmm. and get by without really trying that hard. Which is different from New York, where everyone is there to hustle. Everyone is there to focus on their career 24 hours a day, right? What I've loved about LA is that you didn't have to focus on your career. You could have interests outside of...
Yeah, I see.
So in my decision to sort of combine my drag with my painting life, I don't feel like I could have come to that decision anywhere else other than in the old LA, which was, it was so cheap. You could be an artist and have another
life,
an extracurricular
yeah.
hobby. Right. In New York, it's very much frowned on to do anything other than go to art openings as an artist. And I'm just like, this makes the most boring art. Like to me, the more unique an artist experiences, then they bring something to the table that opens up new ideas. I've always felt like the purpose of art was to, obviously there's nothing new under the sun, but we all get to recombine what exists in our own unique ways that are important to us. So my experiences in the drag scene really opened me up to a lot of possibilities. And there's definitely a few performance artists I saw who open those doorways to me. Elliot Reed is a performer who I saw perform. Elliot Reed was the first person I saw perform using his own voice.
right? There was this idea in performance art that everything had to be very stoic and sort of melodramatic and like the cliches of performance art, right?
Sounds a little bit like the cliches of German art.
Also like absolutely.
Heady, complicated, absolutely. Long, durational.
Exactly. And Elliot Reid would come out and just talk and play music. And it was like there was not this need for this level of mediation, mm-hmm. right? That he was just opening himself and letting something come out rather than channeling it through this like prescribed form.
Mm-hmm.
That was really liberating to watch. And I thought, I'd never thought to just use my own voice in my art, but it feels like the most powerful, like it's the thing I'm most proud of doing is sort of having taken the route through decades of making paintings and just secret drag performances to doing drag performances to now the primarily what I do as an artist is just open my mouth and talk.
In the most amazing gowns,
probably. Exactly.
It's interesting that it's like almost like a, if you said like also the paintings in the beginning, they had this not spoken secret in them, mm-hmm. that suddenly you become like this like walking canvas
mm-hmm.
with added words, mm-hmm. like talking, explaining yourself, like mm-hmm. giving it a voice or something. That's quite it's a nice development or a nice mm-hmm. A thing. Lucky you that it ended that way. Not it's not ending, but
yeah.
That you found this way of expressing yourself.
Exactly. It went from being something that was like a fantasy in my mind to being actually how I live my life. And
yeah.
Like I'm known in both the art world and the drag community as someone with a big mouth who is not afraid to tell you how I feel.
Yeah. Does it always, because I work as a director or in the arts myself, no, it's more like theater, but I know there are like those ups and talking financially, like mm-hmm. sometimes.
Oh, it's been all downs. Financially, it's been all downs.
It's been all downs. But is the thing that you do both, that you work and you can do the clubs and you can do the museum, does that also help? Like
financially, financially, probably no. Financially, I would probably be better to choose one or the other.
Okay, because I always think like if the museums are not calling, I'm doing the club gigs, but that's not the
there way. Is that. I mean, there is that.
Yeah.
And usually between performing in museums and performing in drag spaces, I usually have once a month, I usually have like one fairly well-paying gig and then some that I might be doing for free at a community center or whatever.
Yeah.
But like I have a job. I work at a bar that has drag shows.
Okay.
And I don't need my art to make me money. I've applied for thousands of grants and get almost none of them.
Yeah.
I had actually gotten in to go to grad school in the fall and sort of ended up deciding not to take that because of the way that the Trump presidency is now policing students' free speech. In my financial award letter from a University of California school, it literally said this financial award can be taken away at any time by the whims of the president and you'll be on the hook for the tuition. I'm like, at this point, it would be very hard for me to control what I said as an artist and to not be critical of the Trump administration, who's openly critical of my community.
Yeah.
I can't reciprocate. So the thing that's more important to me than making money, I've mostly been broke my whole life. And honestly, the time I was the least happy was when I was making the most money as an artist, because I had the most strings attached to it. And I had the most people telling me what I could and couldn't say.
I can relate to that.
As an artist. I'm happy to, I don't mind being poor. I don't mind struggling financially, as long as I can feel free to use my voice in any way I see fit.
Yeah.
That freedom to me is more important than recognition by museums. The recognition I get from my community has been the most rewarding thing for me. And every time someone comes up to me and says, like, you're an icon of the trans community, we love that you use your voice to speak up for us, that makes me feel like a successful artist in a way that just getting money from a rich person never did.
I see. Can you maybe describe a little bit how one of your performances, how you create them? Is it like you start with a text and then you create an outfit for it, or is it the other way around? Or how, so maybe that people who are listening to it can also maybe imagine a little bit how those performances look like.
It does. At this point, it's two things come together. I have all these visual ideas in my mind of paintings, gowns. I don't know how things are going to end up, but I just have pictures in my mind that I don't even know how to articulate.
Yeah.
And then also I do spend a lot of time writing and a lot of time editing my writing. So I'll usually write something out longhand and then type it into the computer and edit. 90% of my life is just editing text.
Okay.
At this point. And the part of turning the text into a performance then is I walk around with a microphone just in this empty room. Also, when I'm painting, I have a microphone in my hand and I just narrate what I'm doing and get accustomed to like turning my thoughts into language, finding a rhythm for my language, finding pauses in my language so that I can let a thought sink in or give myself time to think up the next.
Talking is also part of your painting process.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting.
So then I'll have this text that I've written visually, like a piece of writing to be published, and I'll read it and start trying to memorize it and listen to how it sounds, because writing for the ear is very different than writing for the page. Right.
Mm-hmm.
When you write for the page, a reader has the opportunity to go back and reread a paragraph.
Yeah.
But on stage, it's more linear. Right. You have to repeat things in a way. You have to give things time to sink in. You sort of have to simplify things a lot. A funny moment in that piece from the Hammer Museum was based on a true story, and I couldn't remember the person's name, and I wanted to fictionalize it a little bit because it does mention that this person had been convicted of selling drugs in the past.
Yes.
I wanted to protect their identity. And I was thinking, I couldn't remember their name because it was something that happened years ago. But I'm just in here telling the story to the air. And I heard a cricket chirping and I looked down and there was a cricket between my feet. I was like, cricket is the perfect name for a trans girl who is an LSD salesperson who doses people with drugs on a first date.
You are right. And then you have the text and the costume and the design.
They come from various places and they all converge together.
Okay.
I don't claim to, like, my creativity is such a mystery to me. Like, I can tell you more about how my writing process works than how my visual process works, because those things are just images in my mind. I'm a very visual thinker. And costumes, I can't tell you where they come from.
They're just coming.
Just drawing. I draw a lot.
Okay. But you draw them, you draw them and then do make them, or do you just start?
Well, it's a combination. Like, here's another thing that I love to think about is there's the image that you have in your mind, and then to make something in the real world, it's always a compromise with the material reality.
Yes.
Right? Like, painting is all about the tension between our visual thoughts and the physical object that's there.
Yeah.
So then I'll have whatever amount of money I have as my budget for a costume, which is usually not much. So maybe someone will donate, oh, here's 10 yards of this fabric. So then I think, well, I have this vision and I have this fabric. What is the place where those intersect?
Well, that's a nice way of looking at it.
And a lot of times it's sewing is like drawing to me and I'm sort of making it up as I go. And like, I have a direction that I'm pointing myself in, but
yeah,
it's kind of a surprise to me where it ends up.
Yeah. You already touched a little bit on it with this current political situation here in the US. What do you think is like the could be or should be like the role of art, if there is one? Should there be one?
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think that artists have a unique relationship with how people form thoughts about things. And I feel like they can articulate or lead people to articulate from themselves where they stand on something that maybe they've been afraid to take a stand on. Like right now in Los Angeles, we have these mass deportation raids going on. Los Angeles has for many years been a sanctuary city, which says we will not deport undocumented immigrants. And the president hates California, so he's sending people in to do not only that, but also to have quotas on how many people are being deported. So these agents are being rewarded for the number of people they deported and not the degree of a threat that those people pose, right? They're saying they're all killers. They're all rapists, blah, 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 blah. And yet they're raiding like elementary school graduations. They're raiding birthday parties. They're putting 4-year-old children in handcuffs and separating people from their families. I feel like as an artist, if I don't say this is wrong, what is the point? What's the point of being an artist?
Yeah.
If I'm not in a position to publicly say something I think is wrong is happening in my community, then what is the point of our culture if we can't say this is what we do and don't?
Yeah.
This is a line that we aren't willing to go past.